With virtually limitless design options, Pella is like your personal barista for windows and doors. Customize your order by August 31st and you can bundle and save big at Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. Get started today at PellaWI.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. First of all, happy belated Father's Day to everybody, all the fathers out there. Hope you had a great weekend. The weather sort of certainly cooperated. And today, of course, is Juneteenth Day. There has been a big parade downtown that is just in the process of wrapping up. It is also a federal holiday. It became a federal holiday 2 years ago, so there's no mail. Many, many banks are closed. I believe the stock market is closed as well. So if you're waiting for mail, you're going to have to wait until tomorrow. Juneteenth is, of course, a celebration of the day in Texas when some of the last of the slaves found out that the Civil War had ended and they had, in fact, been freed. And it's an Emancipation Day. And I think you can make a strong argument that we should have been having this holiday for years and years as well. It's a federal holiday. Some states recognize it. Some states do not. And maybe we'll do some more Juneteenth-related things a little bit later on in the program. Let us get started. Audience participation. I want to share a story with you, and then my question is, what jumps out at you about this story? It's been reported by many of the TV stations, but this is the way Fox 6 reports it. Milwaukee shooting, 22nd and Clark. Two teen girls were shot in Milwaukee's Amani neighborhood on Sunday morning. Surveillance from a home near 22nd and Clark captured the gunfire, then screams and sheer panic. Surveillance from a home near 22nd and Clark captured the gunfire. Police say the shooting happened Sunday after 1 a.m. Actually, another story says it's actually closer to 1:30 a.m. This would be Saturday night, Sunday morning. Surveillance shows around 15 minutes later, officers arrived in the area to investigate. In the video, only one apparent gunshot is heard, but Milwaukee police say the gunfire injured two girls, ages 14 and 15. It's horrible, says so-and-so. Every single day there's something like this going on in our city. Woman says she lives nearby. Concerned family members heard about the shooting and came to check in on her. My daughter is 18. She came and woke me up, said the lady. She was like, the police have the streets blocked off. Someone was shooting outside and someone got shot. Neighbors say they weren't sure what led to the gunfire, but they don't want to see it again. It's out of control. They're getting younger and younger. Following the shooting, officers focused on at least one home with first responders nearby. At least one girl can be heard screaming from her mother. The two wounded teenagers are expected to be okay. And then it goes on and on. So around 22nd and Clark, 1:30 in the morning, Sunday morning, Saturday night, two kids, two people are shot, one age 14, one age 15. All right, what jumps out at you? Is there anything in particular that jumps out at that story to you? Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. Now, it is unfortunately all too common in our community that you have shootings. And we talk about this. I mean, I could start the show, again, going through a whole raft of shootings that occurred between when I got off the air on Friday and when I'm starting the show today. Various shootings. There was another shooting a couple hours after this. Two people were shot. I don't think either one was killed, you know, downtown Milwaukee. There's another shooting this morning where you had, I think it was a 26-year-old guy who was killed and a 19-year-old person who was injured. But my question to you, is it just this story focusing on what happened 22nd and Clark on Saturday night? Is there something that jumps out at you? 855-616-1620. We'll be back to discuss in just a moment. 855-616-1620. All right, number of people want to weigh in on this. One of our texters says, well, what strikes me is that the police response was 15 minutes. Well, I don't know. I don't know that 15 minutes. I think 15 minutes. I don't know if the individual is suggesting that that's too took too long or that that's a good response. That's not what I was going for. Let's see. Jeff, what jumps out at me is the ages of the child victims. And this text is emblematic of about two dozen texts that we've just received. Jeff, what jumps out at me is the ages of the child victims. What are 14 and 15-year-olds doing out at 1:30 in the morning? It's awful that they were shot, but what is going on? And that is, I think, consistent with again, a couple dozen texts that we have gotten here. And that's what jumped out at me. Now, we don't know all the details, but and I understand that it's summer. I understand that, you know, there's not school that's in session. I understand it's a Saturday night into a Sunday morning. But yeah, and we don't know if they were in a house or they were on the streets or whatever. But does it really make any difference? With all due respect, when I was 14 and 15 years old, I would not, you know, where a 14, you know where you're supposed to be when you're 14 and 15 years old on a Saturday night or whatever at 1:30 in the morning? You're supposed to be in bed. I mean, that's just it. You're supposed to be at home and you're supposed to be in bed. You're not supposed to be out in a situation where you are, where these bad things can happen. I mean, I used to do this jokingly. You know, Wagner's rule of life is that nothing good happens outside a strip club at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that is certainly true, and it remains true. But certainly nothing good happens, you know, on the mean streets of Milwaukee after 2 or 2:30 in the morning. And when you're talking about kids, that is especially true. I was talking about this story with one of my teammates earlier today, and the first response they had is, well, if they were out on the street, doesn't Milwaukee have a curfew? But yes, we have a curfew, but come on, we need to get real. The police are running around dealing with shootings and things like that, and as a practical matter, they're not there to enforce the curfew, and I think that's one of the realities. But to the extent that you have these situations where you have young people that are out on the streets, if that is in fact what happened, and it kind of sounds like it is, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, seriously, out on the streets, pretty much anywhere in this community, at 1:30 on a Saturday, on a Sunday morning, 1:30 at night, you are simply asking for trouble. And I understand that a lot of times we have this fallback position where we say, well, you know, where are the parents and what's going on? Well, there are occasions where I think that's kind of a fair commentary, because I understand it's different than when many of us were raised. But can you imagine at 1:30 in the morning when you're 14 years old, you know, being in a position, being somewhere other than, hey, it's 1:30 in the morning, I don't care, you know, whether there's a citywide curfew or whatever, you're 14 years old, you should be in bed. You know, that's just kind of the reality, and yet that doesn't appear to be the case here. And I think if you look at trying to move away from this individual situation and move towards this kind of broader question, when we're looking at all the violence that's going on in the community, but particularly the violence that is either being perpetrated by or being directed at younger and younger people, you see these stories over and over again where you say, okay, if the kids weren't in a position to, you know, be out on the streets, if the kids, you know, weren't at this event or at that event or whatever, at outrageous hours of at all hours of the day or night, they wouldn't just by definition be in a position to get in these sorts of trouble, in this kind of trouble. And I think, you know, that's a situation. One of our texters said, if I was ever out this late, I'd find myself in the parental version of a police interrogation box. Well, yeah, that's it. That's kind of the question. And I mean, I just always try to picture, look, and I understand kids are kids, and I understand that there's going to be this temptation. You know, you want to push envelopes, you want to get out there. Hey, it's the summer, we don't have anything we have to get up for. But, you know, this is just the reality that's, you know, out there. The whole idea that, you know, this is what's going on. Jeff, to me, frankly, unfortunately, nothing sticks out. This sounds like a recording from last week and the week before that and the week before that. Well, Yeah, and there's no question about that. Jeff, the time for me, a 15 and 16-year-old, actually it's a 14 and a 15-year-old, out at 1:30, really at that age I was home by 10. Nothing good happens after midnight in Milwaukee. Well, yeah, I think that there's an element, you know, to that. And again, it's one of these things that if, look, and I am not victim blaming here. That's not what this is all about. But it's, again, when you know what's going on, when you have young people and they're out on the streets, they put themselves in a position. And I understand that you can get shot at 7 o'clock at night as well, but 1:30 in the morning? Now, come on. John on the north side. John, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. My thought is, you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead.
My thought is this here. Okay, they ought to, not so much the police department, but somebody with authority, they ought to just have a group that just rides out at night that picks up any kid that's out and take them right to some detention center for 10 days. I mean, your parents can't even get you out. You got 10 days in there because you shouldn't be out at that time of night. I mean, something's got to happen because, like they say, is a revolving door, and you keep talking about the same thing. You're talking right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why they don't pick you for it. The guy.
John, let me ask you this. I mean, do you think the community would support that? If there was just this policy, we've got a curfew that is in place, and we're going to vigorously enforce it, and we're going to do exactly what you just said. We're going to take a group of police officers, and we're going to say, okay, next Friday night, they're going to start aggressively policing, and when they find, kids that are out on the street after midnight, well after curfew, they're going to round them up, they're going to take them to detention, they're going to hold them there for however long they hold them. Do you think the community would support that or would be hearing this outrage? Oh, my gosh, you're locking up these kids. I mean, is that what the community really wants, do you think?
Well, do the community still want these kids out there late at night with guns and everything else? I mean, like you said, nothing can happen. Something's got to happen. Now, the community is going to have to get with the police and get it together and say, look, this has got to stop. You know, Milwaukee used to be a good place. You know, we have to stop these kids from doing whatever they're doing if they're out after 12 o'clock at night. You know, come on now. You know, the community's got to deal with that. The mayor and what have you and whoever's in authority of that, they need to sit down and say, look, we don't care what you think. This is what we're going to do. We're not going to have these kids running around in the middle of the night.
Well, John, thanks for the call. You are preaching to the choir, and I know I'm preaching to the choir when I talk to you about it. I guess my big question is, are we ready for that? And I have some people that are texting me saying, well, this underscores the problem with the proliferation of guns and things like that. Well, okay. Yes, guns in the wrong hands, I mean, leads to the shooting. There's no question about that. But still, when you have people that, especially younger people, that are out well after curfew and on the streets, they put themselves in the positions where this kind of bad stuff can happen. So I like your idea, John. I'd love to see the police be more aggressive. My question, though, is whether that's really what people want. Maybe people, who call into a program like mine want it or text into a program like mine. But does the community in general, do we want to see kids picked up and detained, if nothing else, for their own good? I pose that question to the people in authority. Sometimes it just is what it is. Here's a story that I think the jury is kind of still out on the motive, not the underlying situation. If you haven't been following this, there's a Milwaukee County supervisor, Peter Burgelis, B-U-R-G-E-L-I-S. And if I'm mispronouncing the name, I apologize. But anyhow, here is the story. He is an openly gay member of the county board. So here's the way Urban Milwaukee reports it. Milwaukee County supervisor was attacked Friday at Mayfair Mall in Wauwatosa. He was punched following an incident in the parking lot, and the attack left him so injured that he required facial surgery at Frederick Health. The dispute was over a parking issue that it occurred earlier in the lot, a spokesman for the Wauwatosa Police Department told the online newspaper. And so apparently, as near as I'm able to figure out, it's one of these parking lot road rage things where the supervisor is pulling into a space at Mayfair and somebody doesn't like the way he pulled in or he's backing up or whatever, and an argument ensues. Okay, so unfortunately, it happens all too often. So there's this dispute in the parking lot. The supervisor says, I walked away from the guy in the parking lot, walked away from him in the mall. About 6 minutes later, I was checking out and paying for something at the Avita store when where the register is right near the mall entrance. I got sucker punched from behind. I stumbled but did not fall. The supervisor said his assailant issued a homophobic slur at the moment of the attack. He says, I don't think I'm terribly flamboyant, but I do wear a rainbow bracelet. Not sure if the assailant thought I'd be an easier target. He also released a statement saying, I will never be silenced, nor will I allow this act of violence to detract from our ongoing efforts to secure acceptance and equality for the LGBTQ+ community. If anything, this assault serves as a stark reminder of the pervasive challenges we continue to face, says his press release. I guess here was my take on this. First of all, he's clearly a victim, and the person who did this deserves to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And unfortunately, this is just all too endemic of what happens nowadays, where you have the examples of road rage or parking lot rage or whatever, where you have people who get upset and they stalk you and they end up attacking people. And these punch-out things, unfortunately, occur on a very, very regular basis. So there's no question that whoever is responsible for this deserves to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Where I think the jury is out on this case is what was the real basis for the attack? Was this guy attacked because of his sexual orientation, or was he attacked because he runs into some parking lot rage psycho who gets upset with whatever it was he did and decides to follow him around and punches him out? So, I mean, I think that's the one where the jury is still out. Now, I understand the supervisor says that there was a homophobic slur that was issued right after the punch was thrown. I guess I don't know. It'll be interesting to see when the more information comes, because I think they know the guy, that somebody probably got his license plate because it was a parking lot thing. They'll be able to figure out what the motive was. Doesn't diminish the fact that the supervisor was attacked. Doesn't diminish the fact that he was significantly injured. I do think, though, you know, it's fair to say, okay, what was this? Was this an attack based on his sexual orientation, or instead was this just simply an attack based on the parking lot rage, something that happens all too frequently in this community, happens all too frequently in public, and it happens all too frequently at the Mayfair Mall. So, very glad to have you with us. If you are somebody who grew up, I don't know, watching court TV and watching the various trials over the years of Jeffrey Dahmer. Remember Jeffrey Dahmer? That was a trial that was televised on court TV. The O.J. Simpson murder case. Remember that the country was riveted back in the mid-1990s, where you had the testimony on a daily basis, and it made maybe, I don't know, stars or anti-heroes of some of the participants that were involved in that. You're used to seeing proceedings, including criminal proceedings, on television. Most states allow court proceedings, both civil and criminal, to be televised. Now, the truth of the matter is, most proceedings aren't going to be televised. They're not newsworthy enough to merit, you know, putting cameras in the courtroom and showing constant sort of coverage. But the idea behind putting cameras in the courtroom is that courtrooms are open. The public has a right to know and to see the process. Now, in the state courts that allow cameras in the courtrooms, there's still restrictions that judges will put in place. It is common, for example, that the jurors cannot be shown, you know, the jurors' faces can't be shown in situations where there might be minors that testify or there may be victims of sexual assault that testify. The rules will say, okay, they can't You know, they can't be filmed. You can't show their faces or things like that. But in general, the trials are held and the public gets a chance to see them. And you get to see what goes on in the courtroom, right? That is not the case in federal courts. There's a rule of federal criminal procedure that says that cameras are not allowed in the courtrooms. In federal court. And the thinking behind this, and this goes back to the beginning, the thinking behind this is there's concerns about the confidentiality of jurors. There's concerns about judicial decorum that maybe the participants, the attorneys or whatever, would play to the cameras, and it might somehow, again, judicial decorum, or it might create a distraction if you have cameras in the courtroom. So for years and years and years, that has been the policy. And despite the fact that the experience of the state courts shows that you can allow cameras in the courtroom, you can allow the general public to see what goes on, the federal courts have not allowed that. Arguments before the United States Supreme Court are not televised. You know, you don't get to see those arguments. Now, again, my guess is that most arguments, people wouldn't, you know, go in and watch the hearings. They can be, you know, spectators can go in and can see them, and members of the press can go in and they can listen to them, and then they can report on what was said. But at the same time, you're then getting a spin. You're getting the filtered through the eyes of the reporter. It's why when, for example, there's federal criminal cases, and if you ever wonder why isn't there any still photography? Well, no cameras. Still cameras or TV cameras are not allowed in the courtrooms. That's why they bring in the sketch artists and sketch artists do the drawing. When Donald Trump was arraigned last week, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's this controversy that's developed because they had one of the sketch artists that came in and drew Donald Trump sitting at the table, you know, with the defendants. And some people thought that the sketch was too flattering, that they then put on TV, was too flattering to Donald Trump. Other people thought the sketch was too unflattering, proving once again that you can't, you know, make everybody happy. All right, so where are we going with this? Well, there will be a time, assuming that the pretrial motions don't get the case kicked, there will be a time when Donald Trump goes to trial. He's been indicted, United States District Court, Southern District of Florida versus Donald Trump on the whole documents thing. There will be a trial. Will the trial happen before the end of this year? Doubtful. Will the trial happen sometime next year? It probably will. But one of the things that at least right now is not going to happen is that cameras are not going to be allowed in the courtroom. So the public, you and me, we are not going to be able to watch the trial. We are going to have to depend on the third-party accounts of, you know, whatever reporters are given access to the trial. But it's not going to be in a position to be televised. The first in history trial, criminal trial in federal court of a former president is not going to be able to be watched by the voters in this country. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. I have always thought that this rule, and this is from my perspective going back to the 80s as a federal prosecutor, I have always thought that this rule barring cameras in federal courtrooms was antiquated at best. All these different reasons, well, you know, the lawyers might play up to the cameras or whatever. It's, you know, as a practical matter, we've got 50 states that almost all allow trials to be televised, and you don't have problems with that. That's on the one hand. The other hand is I think the general public has a right to see these trials, and especially in a trial of the nature of the former president of the United States, I think the general public, I think it would be in the interest of justice, and it would be in the interest of, candidly, the general public to say that the First Amendment should, since it's an open courtroom, we don't have star chamber sort of things, I think the public should have the right to see that trial. Nobody says you have to watch it, but if ABC or NBC or Court TV or MSNBC or Fox News, or probably all of them, if they want to televise that trial of Donald Trump, I think it is in everybody's interest for people to be able to see it and to have a rule in place that says, well, no cameras in the courtroom. We're not going to allow people to watch this and form their own opinions about what's going on. I think it's certainly bad for democracy. I think it's bad for this country, and I think it's completely unnecessary. Our number, 855-616-1620, that is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Should the Trump trial, when it occurs, should it be televised? And if not, why not? We discuss in just a moment. 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. Sometime probably next year, assuming the case is not tossed on pretrial motions, which I don't believe it's going to be, Donald Trump is going to stand trial. He's been indicted, and he's going to go into that Miami courthouse, and the government, the U.S. government, will try to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty of the various crimes that are charged in the indictment. We, collectively, the people, are not going to be able to watch that trial. Now, there will be a limited number of reporters who are allowed in, and they can, you know, they can take their notes of what happens and they can report on it, but you're not going to be able to see it because the federal courts continue to hang on to what I believe is this archaic idea of no cameras in the courtrooms. If this trial were in the state of Wisconsin, the trial, it could be televised. You could put cameras in the courtroom. They televise criminal trials. They televise non-criminal trials. And we're able to get through it. I mean, just think about, remember the most recent, I think, high-profile case around here that got televised was the Daryl Brooks case. And there were rules regarding, you know, what the cameras could show and not show. But I think it went a long way towards people who were interested in watching it, seeing what actually happens in the courtroom. There were all these allegations that the judge, in this case Jennifer Doro, was she being fair to Brooks, et cetera, et cetera. People were able to watch it. They were able to watch the trial. They were able to watch snippets on the TV news and conclude for themselves. And I think the general sense was Daryl Brooks got a fair trial. In the Trump case, there are already the federal judge that this has been assigned to is a Trump appointee who has limited trial experience, at least limited criminal trial experience. And there's already things saying, well, you know, she's going to be in the bag for Donald Trump or whatever. Now, I don't know if that's the case or not, but if you televise the case, if you show what is going on in the courtroom, and I understand that some people only see what they want to see, but if you televise this, the general public can watch it and it can at least conclude, oh, that this judge was fair, the judge wasn't fair. One of our texters says, Jeff, do you think that the O.J. Simpson case, very, very good question, by the way, do you think that the result in the O.J. Simpson trial would have been different had the attorneys not been allowed to grandstand for the TV cameras? My answer is no. And here's why. It wasn't the fact that they were able to grandstand for the TV cameras. The reason O.J. Simpson was convicted is the trial judge, in this case Lance Ito, remember that name from the past, completely lost control of the courtroom and allowed the defense attorneys to grandstand for the jury. I mean, that's I don't think the presence of TV cameras made much difference one way or the other in the verdict. What it ended up doing is, for at least a brief period of time, it made, you know, stars of some of the people, you know, who participated, you know, Marsha Clark and things like that. I mean, the fact that the prosecutors, who, in my opinion, completely and totally blew an overwhelming case, you know, they became mini celebrities. Some of the defense attorneys became mini celebrities, and TV might have contributed or did contribute to that. But the overall verdict, no, to the extent, I mean, the prosecution, I think, did a very, very questionable job. And, you know, the judge just completely lost control of it. So that's what I look at the O.J. Simpson case. But if you've got a judge who, if you've got a judge, you know, who keeps control, no. I mean, I don't think there's any problem at all. 855-616-1620. Jeff, we should be able to watch the trial and form our own opinion, one that is not influenced by the media. Nothing can be taken out of context. We can see and hear for ourselves. You know, absolutely. And again, I'm not naive enough to argue that that it's necessarily going to change everybody's minds. There are people who view Donald Trump as the Antichrist and, you know, don't care what the evidence is that's presented. They want to see him convicted. Similarly, there are diehard, you know, Trump cult followers who think that this is nothing but a witch hunt, et cetera, et cetera. And regardless of what the verdict, we'll never move from that particular position. But I do believe that there's a large chunk of this country, particularly people who aren't necessarily familiar with the nuances of the court system, who I think that showing what goes on in the courtroom would at least go a long way to saying if Trump is convicted, he got a fair trial. If Trump is acquitted, he got a fair trial. There's just no question about, you know, that. Jeff, we're paying for it. We should be able to watch it. Well, I think that that's, you know, I think that there is an issue. It's more, it's not so much paying for it. It's more like the fact that the courts are public places. We don't, this is not Russia. We do not have secret trials, okay? We don't try people behind closed doors. We don't do that. We open up the courtrooms. And given that this is 2023, the idea that we open up state courtrooms and allow the public to watch because stuff is televised, the idea that, well, somehow, I don't know, we can't do that in federal courtrooms because federal courtrooms, we've just like never done it. Jeff, televised the Trump trial. He's been having many firsts at everything. First former president to be indicted. Televised this for the first, you know, time. Well, I mean, that's it. One of our texters says it should be televised. You know, who established this rule? Could it change? Yes, the rule that prohibits cameras in the courtroom, it's not a law. You don't need Congress to get involved. It is part of the federal rules of criminal procedure. It is a rule which is essentially passed by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court could change that rule, or they could modify that rule to allow, I don't know, trial judges the discretion to televise cases if they wanted within certain rules. And like I say, you're going to always have rules. One of our texters is saying, well, there's classified documents that are going to be discussed, so don't televise it. Well, there's going to be reporters in the courtroom, so there are going to be, to the extent that there are classified documents that are going to be discussed, they're going to be discussed in open court. So there's going to be certain limitations placed on what's going to be said in open court regarding these things or what the content of them is. But it's not like, okay, well, there's classified documents, so we can't trust the general public to find out about it, because there are going to be reporters that are going to be in there reporting on it. We do not have secret trials in this country. I just think on so many levels, and I one of the things that concerns me about the charges against Donald Trump and the ultimate outcome and where we are in this country is the whole concept of democracy and the idea that, okay, some people have that Donald Trump can't get a fair trial, or the idea that some people have that Donald Trump is obviously guilty, et cetera, et cetera. I just think the more we show people and more we are open, the more we are transparent about what's going on, the more confidence it instills in the system. That's all. As if professional sports did not have enough problems. I don't know if you saw the story. The U.S. national team played Mexico last Thursday night in Las Vegas, and U.S. was winning 3-0. The game was called early because a number of Mexican soccer fans started chanting this homophobic slur. That apparently has been going on in Mexican soccer for years. They apparently, this is the tradition, you yell at the opposing goalkeeper during his run-up to take a goal kick. It's a tradition, and I'm not going to say the term, but in Spanish it essentially means gay prostitute. That's what they're yelling. And it's of course, offensive, and they've been told, okay, you can't do this. But that doesn't stop the fans from doing it. And apparently they were chanting and chanting this, and, you know, the announcer came out and instructed them to, you know, not do this and stop it. And all that did was inspire them to do it more. And ultimately, with a couple minutes left, the referees called called the game off. They simply said, okay, they've apparently there's this protocol that they followed. If the chant is heard, I mean, first you stop play, then you warn the fans. If the chants continue, step two is match suspension. It is suspended, and players are instructed to return to their dressing room until the offending behavior stops. The third and final step is simply to abandon the match after consultation with the team's captains and venue security. And on Thursday night, they just said, okay, we're done with this. So the real question becomes, are the fans going to be able to control themselves moving forward? And is it fair to punish the teams and the fans of their teams who aren't in the stands for the uncouth, offensive behavior of the fans who are in the stands? But my guess is you're going to see this happen more and more often moving forward. So in any event, the game was suspended. The U.S. ended up winning. They were going to win regardless. But you wonder what's going to happen if there is a close game sometime and Mexico's behind by a goal or something, and this all happens with 30 minutes left in the game instead of 3 minutes. Will the fans wake up?
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. I was out and about quite a bit this weekend, and I want to say a very special thank you, because it seemed like, my wife was saying, it seemed like everywhere we go, we had people who were coming up and introducing themselves and saying that they've been listening over the years, and I very, very much appreciate that. That's always, it's always very gratifying to hear people say, oh, you know, you're kind of a part of our day. We listen to you on a regular basis. And to that end, if you can't listen to the entire program Monday through Friday, noon to three, we have our podcast page, and I know a lot of you do that as well. You can access that through WTMJ.com or anywhere you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple iTunes. We are there. So if you missed a program or you missed a portion of a day's program and you want to go back and hear it, we make it easy to do that. We also, now, as we've been doing for about the last month or so, we now live stream it. So, and I'm always amazed at how many people choose to watch spoken word radio. But you can simply go to WTMJ.com, and instead of hitting the listen live button, which allows you to get the radio feed, you can hit the watch live button, which takes you into our studio, and you can see the cameras, and you can see how my wife stressed me on any given day, and check that out. So you can access that through, again, WTMJ.com, the Watch Live feature, or alternatively, we've got a YouTube channel, and you can go back and you can watch it. Again, I'm always amazed at how many people choose to do that. So however you want to take in the program, we make it easy for you to do that. All right. Because I am a news junkie and because I am a political junkie, I read and watch a lot of things in some respects so you don't have to. I try to kind of summarize this, and we are, of course, still a long way off from the election season, November of 2024. But there's already a lot of jockeying going on, and there is this sort of consensus, a consensus, by the way, that I reject. But a consensus, if you read the national pundits, that, oh my gosh, this is going to be, what you're going to be looking at is a replay of the 2020 election, that the Democrat nominee is going to be Joe Biden, the Republican nominee is going to be Donald Trump, and it's really not going to change. And people look at poll numbers. See, here's, even though Trump's been indicted, and even though there's a polls out that say that 60% of the people want him to drop out, he still has overwhelming support among Republican voters. We'll see. I mean, I think, and again, I understand that maybe I'm an outlier. I continue to believe that Donald Trump will not be the Republican nominee in 2024, simply because I think at some point in time, Republicans collectively are going to get over what would be an electoral death wish and come to the realization that Donald Trump cannot win a general election given all his baggage, and that he's probably the only major Republican who's in the race that would, in fact, go ahead and lose to Joe Biden. I think that's the case. But right now, the story that's emerging in the media narrative that, we're here, it's mid-June of 2023, and maybe by mid-June of 2024, as we're approaching the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, maybe 12 or 13 months from now, you'll be able to access this tape and go back and say, boy, were you wrong about this, Wagner? I'm willing to do that. Because, again, I don't think this is what it's going to be at the end of the day. But right now, the narrative is it's going to be Trump, it's going to be Biden. The headline in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, no one is looking forward to the 2024 presidential election. Subheading, Trump's indictment and a low approval rating for Biden are leading to voter dread with 16 months to election day. As Donald Trump entered a Miami courtroom last week to face federal charges, drawing a raucous crowd and a crush of news media, John Newman felt fatigued by the thought that 16 months of a presidential campaign were yet to come. I wish I had a fast forward button, said Newman, a political independent in Chicago who is looking for a moderate Republican to support, but fears Trump will crowd out his rivals. Welcome to the election of dread. If there's one thing that voters of both parties and independents agree on, it's that few are looking forward to the run-up to November of 2024. The two leading candidates, Trump and Biden, look to be heading for a repeat of 2020, and few see much to relish in that. Our number, 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. I could not agree more. The idea, no matter how you look at it, the idea of Trump-Biden redo in 2024 fills me with just a, we'll start with the word dread, but move on with the idea of really collectively as a country, can't we do better than an agent of chaos like Donald Trump, who finds himself under federal indictment, under state criminal charges, who has shown to be divisive and is shown to, you know, have lost, you know, one election after another, if you look at like the midterms and things like that. So from the Republican perspective, can't you do better? From the Democratic perspective, regardless of what you think about Joe Biden as a person, as we've talked about before, he's going to be 82 years old, for God's sake, if he is reelected, which means if he makes it through the next term, he's going to be 86. And you watch Joe Biden, and it is clear that he is slipping. I think it's impossible to argue otherwise. It is clear that he is slipping. Our number, 855-616-1620, the idea of a Biden-Trump rematch a year and a half from now, how do you react to that? And I think the word dread is a good one. 855-616-1620. And I just can't believe that in this country, with all the different powerful politicians that are out there, that the voters, both Democratic and Republican voters, are going to settle for candidates that candidly are either uninspiring, have significant issues like age, or significant issues like chaos agents and federal criminal indictments. 855-616-1620. How do you feel about the idea that it's going to be a Trump-Biden rematch in November of 2024? We discuss in just a moment. See, you can think that Donald Trump was the greatest thing since canned beer as a president, and you can think that he's being unfairly treated by these charges, and at the same time say, okay, he's going to be 77 years old, or it's time for a change, because he is an agent of chaos, and the Republicans need to find somebody younger, somebody more vibrant, somebody without the baggage, all right? You can say, hey, I like Joe Biden, but at the same time, he's 80. He would be 82 if he was elected. His popularity, it's not like Biden is doing well. His popularity is consistently stuck in the low 40s. So, you know, Democrats, if you look at pretty much every poll of Democrats, they say, we think he's too old. You know, we wish there was somebody else. But yet there doesn't appear to be any movement to find that somebody else except, you know, crazy Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It is amazing to me that we find ourselves in this situation. And I think if it is Trump Biden redo, a year and a half from now, I think dread is an absolutely positive way to discuss this. Let's start with Mike in Illinois. Mike, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeff. How are you?
Good. What do you think?
So I've always been critical of people who would say, well, I'm not voting for anybody. You know, they're all crooks. They're all bad. Well, this, if that comes to pass, Biden, Trump, 2024, this may be the first election that I won't vote in. I've voted since I was 18. I just can't, in good conscience, vote for either one of them. They both are somewhat delusional. One, you know, is for whatever reason he is, and the other one, I don't care about how old a person is as long as they're cognitively okay. But, you know, Biden goes in and out of lucidity. So I just don't think either one. I think we can do, I think it's pretty much common knowledge that we could do better.
Well, absolutely, Mike. That's exactly it. And that's why this is what is so frustrating to me for, again, the Republicans out there who, you know, like Donald Trump, think he's victimized. At the same time, can't you take the blinders off and recognize that there are other more electable choices than Donald Trump that would represent a lot of the same policies, but without all the baggage and without the huge ego and without the chaos and all of that, and who aren't under federal indictment? All right, you've got that. And from the Democratic side, exactly. You can say, oh, Joe Biden seems like a nice guy, but, you know, his popularity stuck in the 40s. It's not like, you know, anybody is arguing that, you know, Joe Biden has been the second coming of FDR or anything like that. And everybody, I think, acknowledges that once you hit a certain age, it's probably time to pack it in. And Biden doesn't appear to be willing to do that. So these are all these warning flags that are up there. And yet we're apparently accepting of this. You don't see any Democrats, any of the big name Democrats mounting a challenge to Biden. You don't see, well, I mean, the Trump strategy is, there's lots of Republicans running. The Trump strategy is to hope that, you know, that you can get 30% of the primary vote, and that's going to be enough to sweep you in, which would be an electoral disaster for Republicans. It's just dread. Dread is the right word. Rachel in Mount Pleasant. Rachel, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, Jeff. Hi. Thanks for bringing this topic up. It has been driving me absolutely bonkers thinking that possibility of Trump-Biden again. I don't even understand. What in the heck are we thinking? We have to do better. We have to.
Well, just different sort of things from both perspectives for the reasons I said and others as well. There's a time where you just got to pass the torch, and we're at that point. So do you think it's going to happen, Rachel, or do you think people are going to come to their senses before the election?
I mean, I can hope that people do better. Absolutely. 100%. But my belief in people is slowly waning throughout the years as I get older. So, I mean, I do hope. I know that the conversations you're not supposed to talk about with people sometimes, you know, politics, money, religion, those are my three absolutely favorite topics to talk about with
right.
friends, family, strangers, anyone who will listen to me. And I'm a mostly Republican voter for many, many years now. And I like the last caller. I don't know if I would vote. I
agree.
Good conscience, you know,
no, I'm with you,
I guess.
No, thanks for calling, Rachel. I don't see how I could vote for Donald Trump with all the stuff that went on. The election was stolen, and the January 6th stuff, and the various indictments and things like that. I think we need to do better. And I mean, I have lots of friends on the other side of the aisle. I really do. And I get, discussing with them, I get no enthusiasm at all for Joe Biden. It's not like, oh, we think that this is going to be inspirational. We think that he's going to be, well, Bill Clinton, you know, for all Clinton's flaws, you know, Clinton had generated just a lot of, you know, positive sort of stuff. Same thing for Obama. You know, you might have thought, you might not have agreed with Obama, but these were candidates that people could get excited about, et cetera, et cetera. Ronald Reagan was one of those type of candidates. Neither Biden nor Trump is that. And both of them come with just incredible baggage. And again, I just keep going back to this notion that we have to do, you know, better. Jeff, it's absolutely ridiculous because of the only two candidates we can come up with. Personally, I like Ted Cruz and Robert Kennedy Jr. I don't think he's bad either. I'm not going party line. I'm going on who's most qualified. Yeah, well, whoever the candidates are, we've got to be able to do better. Jeff, I'm a Democrat, and I'm dreading this election. I abhor Trump, but I think Biden's time has run its course. help in capital letters. That's kind of how I feel. I mean, it's like help, for goodness sakes, here. Jeff, I agree with your callers 100%. I don't think I can vote for either. Well, that's kind of it. Jeff, there's a huge silent majority out there. Trump would probably win by a landslide. Who's kidding who? I don't buy that at all. Trump didn't win in 2020, and he hasn't done anything since 2020 to reach out to the type of voters that you're going to need to win in those five or six states that you need to win. I think if Trump is the candidate, it pretty much guarantees that Biden gets reelected, and Trump is probably the only guy that does that. I think right now you could put any one of the other major Republican candidates out there, make them the nominee, and they beat Biden decisively. I just think that's it. That's it. Biden, I think, and look, and I understand you got polls. Well, Trump outpolls both Biden, these things. You know, Trump has been losing elections. He lost in 2020. You can't explain to me, you know, what he's done to expand his base. Nope. I just don't think that that's the case at all. But regardless of whether it's Trump or Biden, we deserve better choices. We should have better choices. Jeff, like Charlie Brown used to say, good grief. Yes, that's it. Jeff, I have three words. Are you serious? Exclamation point. I can't believe that either party, we can't come up with better candidates. You know, other countries probably just shake their heads. That's I guess, the overall point. And I will tell you, as somebody who makes a living 5 days a week, 3 hours a day, discussing current events, which of course includes politics and will continue to include politics, obviously, as we move up to the 2024 presidential election, the idea of Joe Biden and Donald Trump as the two dominant forces, wow. I mean, that's all I can say. Wow. It's just, I think it's going to, I understand there's maybe a hardcore a group of supporters on either side. But I think for most people, Republicans, most Democrats, and most independents, the reaction is, can't we do better? And my response would be, yes, we can. Will we? That's the big question. Here's a text. Jeff, do you mean to tell me that in America we can't come up with two better candidates than guys who were in their 70s and 80s? Younger people, please. Well, interestingly enough, there's a piece in the New York Times over the weekend, and I read the New York Times, so you don't have to. Ron DeSantis, and I understand DeSantis is controversial, but here's what it says. Ron DeSantis is young, has little kids, and wants America to know it. At 44, he's more than three decades younger than Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and he is subtly playing up that age gap. As top-tier presidential candidates go, Ron DeSantis is something of a rarity these days. He was born after the Vietnam War. He came of age when computers were common in American homes, and he still has young children of his own, rather than enough grandchildren to fill a basketball team. Mr. DeSantis would be 46 on Inauguration Day if elected, younger than every president since John F. Kennedy. That's a fact he doesn't state explicitly, but his campaign has set out to make sure voters get it. The Florida governor talks frequently about having the energy and discipline needed for the White House, keeping a busy schedule of morning and evening events. He and his wife often speak about their young children who are 6, 5, and 3 and have joined their parents on the campaign trail. One of the few with kids still at home, Mr. DeSantis regularly highlights his parental worries about schools and popular culture as he presses his agenda. Yeah, that's the thing. And, you know, I got to believe that that is going to be a compelling thing. It is, because we all want people that we can identify with. That's just the truth. And at some point in time, all right, if your only choices are, again, somebody who's 77 and somebody who's 82 and would be 86, I think people want different options. And, I mean, DeSantis is doing it subtly. My guess is the campaign emerges and it goes on, it's going to be less and less subtle. Gee, somebody who's 46 who becomes the president instead of somebody who would be 86 when he leaves the presidency. What a novel concept. So very glad to have you with us. I understand, of course, this is Juneteenth Day, which is a federal holiday, and it's been for the last couple of years. So no mail today. Many banks, many financial institutions are closed. The stock markets are closed as well. So if we're expecting something in the mail today and you're wondering why you're not getting it, well, it's because it is not open, period. Quick reminder, Summerfest starts this week. Matter of fact, in the 2:30 hour of today's program, we've got a Summerfest-related topic. But Summerfest starts on Thursday. Summerfest this year is going to be like Summerfest last year. It's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday for three consecutive weeks. And this is, by the way, I mean, the people I talk to who are, you know, pretty high up in Summerfest or on the Summerfest board, the jury is still out on this. I mean, the question is, you know, moving forward, what is going to be, how is it going to work? And this year is really going to be, I think, a pretty good indicator. You know, 2 years ago, when they did this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, it was in September, you know, and we were coming out of COVID, and that wasn't a really good indication. And last summer, they did Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, but it was still kind of, you know, coming out of the COVID sort of thing. This is going to be, I think, the first year where it's going to be a really fair test of, you know, what does Thursday, Friday, and Saturday over three consecutive weeks do? What does it do for, you know, entertainment? Does it change it from a continuous festival to like a series of concerts? Is it tougher to maintain that kind of momentum? And all these things are open questions. What does it do for attendance? What does it do for revenue for the festival? What does it do for revenue for the vendors? And I don't think anybody actually knows, but I think this year is probably going to be a fair test of it, assuming that the weather isn't, you know, a defining factor. I mean, it doesn't matter who you talk to, anybody that puts on festivals, whether it's a church festival or an ethnic festival or a big event like Summerfest, one of the things that they will always tell you is they are so incredibly weather dependent. You get a bad weather day, you get a cold day, you get a rainy day, you get a cold and rainy day, and no matter how great the entertainment is, it kills attendance. So, you know, you're always going to be susceptible to that. I was looking at the weather forecast for at least this week, and Thursday, Friday, and Saturday look like about as perfect weather as you can possibly get, which, you know, that's good. Summerfest deserves that, you know, and needs that. Last week, when they had Polish Fest, they had, I'm told, great attendance on Friday and Saturday. And if you remember what the weather was like a week ago Sunday, it was, in a word, crappy. It was cold. It was rainy. And my understanding is that Sunday attendance at Polish Fest just plummeted because, again, you're not going to go down to an outdoor festival. You're not going to walk around. You're not going to sit on the bleachers or whatever and listen to music when it's 50 degrees and it's raining, or at least not too many people are going to do that. So, you know, hopefully Summerfest will get some really good weather. We are going to be broadcasting. My show is going to be originating from the Summerfest grounds almost every Thursday and Friday over those three consecutive weekends, certainly this Thursday and this Friday. I think there might be one day out of that somewhere along the line, maybe July 6th or something, where there's a early baseball game. So I'm not going to be down there that day. But if you happen to be down on the Summerfest grounds, especially while my program is going on or while Wisconsin's Afternoon News is going on, stop by and say hello. We absolutely love to see you. Okay. Here, I want to discuss a concept with you and get your reaction to this. Now hear me out on this. One of the effects of COVID and the pandemic has been to really, really, really impact downtown office workers. Now, I'm not just talking about downtown Milwaukee, but that's true. But downtown Chicago, downtown Oakland, San Francisco, whatever. San Francisco in particular has been hit really, really hard because what happened is people started working remotely during the pandemic, and many of them, so they didn't go into work, and many of them have just simply said, okay, we're not coming into work. And for a lot of downtown office workers, that's just now become the norm. more and more companies are trying to encourage or force or whatever you want to say their employees to come back downtown, but they're being met with all sorts of resistance. So in pretty much every big city around the country, you look at it and you're going to find that, you know, occupancy rates are down just substantially over, you know, what they were before COVID. And the truth is, I think a lot of people realize that, you know, that's happening, and those office workers, you know, just aren't, they're not going to come back, or they're not going to come back anytime soon or in any sort of significant numbers. So one of the effects of that has been to have a massive impact on mass transit, because let's say you had, let's say you had workers, let's move away from Milwaukee where we don't have a subway, but you have workers who would work downtown and would regularly commute in Chicago. They take the L train, or in Oakland, in San Francisco, they call it the BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit. So to get to work, what they would do is they would take the BART. They would take the subway. Well, if they're not coming to work, there's less and less need for it, and the numbers are kind of staggering. BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit, their ridership post-COVID, 32%, which means 32%, you know, it's down to 32%, and it appears to be that's consistent. The San Francisco subway, that's at 58%. L.A., train and bus system, 58%. New York subway and bus network is at 72%, which is better, but that's still down substantially from where it was post-COVID. And I think most downtown areas are recognizing that, like I say, that's not coming back anytime soon, which brings me to Milwaukee. And, you know, the stories, you've probably been seeing them is, well, the headline in the local newspaper the other day was, prepping for a fiscal cliff, it hopes doesn't come, Milwaukee County Transit projects hits to more than half of its routes. And this is all in the concept of the whole shared revenue thing, but they're talking about how, you know, unless there's substantial funding that comes in, what's going to happen is that maybe as many as half of the bus routes are going to have to be cut, because there's fewer and fewer people that are riding the buses, and that revenue isn't going to be there. I pulled up the numbers, the funding sources for the bus system, and kind of did the math. It costs, as of 2022, approximately $160 million to run the Milwaukee County bus system. Of that, about 38%, $62 million, comes from the federal government. Now, a big chunk of that was pandemic money, the American Rescue Plan Act, that's going to expire by the end of 2024, which is going to create a vacuum. But you've got about $62 million that comes from the feds. The state government kicks in about $55 million, which is 34%. Local funds, $17 million, which is 11%. So the government right now underwrites about 83% of the cost of the bus system, which leaves passenger fares and other revenue, which would be like bus advertising and stuff, that's about 17%. That's $27 million. So you've got declining people, fewer people who are using public transit, in large part, again, because a lot of people, hey, they don't need, if they used to ride the bus to work, they don't need to ride the bus to work anymore, because that's just the nature of the job. So you've got $27 million or so, which comes from passenger revenue and which comes from, like I say, advertising. At the same time, you've got fewer and fewer people who depend on this. So a number of communities are trying to figure out how they can encourage more people to use mass transit. And one of the ideas that's being kicked around is to simply make it free. To simply say, okay, just like Milwaukee County is doing it with the not so rapid bus line, the thing that they just started that runs from the lakefront out to the medical college, it's going to be quote unquote free for the next 4 months to try to get riders to ride it, hoping they get used to it so that when they eventually start charging, they will pay for it. The hop, remember, the hop was originally supposed to charge a dollar per ride. They had the Pottawatomie Casino that underwrote the cost for the first year, and then Pottawatomie pulled out, and now they continue to make it free because they know if they charge even 50 cents for it, the ridership, which is already pathetically low, is going to end up becoming non-existent. So here's my question. Given the fact that there is, you know, you need mass transit, and you need people to ride it, should we just bite the bullet and say, let's make the bus fares free in the effort to try to get more people on there? Now, nothing is free, so that means taxpayers would have to underwrite a larger percentage of it. But is it worth it to have a viable existing mass transit system? Free bus rides. What do you think? 855-616-1620. We discuss. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. I mean, regardless of what happens with shared revenue, people have to understand that for mass transit around here, there is a fiscal cliff that we're heading for really, really quickly. I mean, right now, again, my numbers, about $160 million a year to run the bus system. Okay, the Milwaukee County Transit, and a large part of that, by my math, like about $20 million or so, maybe a little, well, $62 million comes from the feds, but a good chunk of that $62 million is COVID money, the American Relief Plan Act, and that's gonna disappear by the end of next year, which is going to leave a $25-30 million hole in the budget that has to be replaced. Meanwhile, you have fewer and fewer people that are riding the buses for a variety of reasons, in part because a lot of people aren't commuting. If you were an office worker and you lived in Glendale or whatever, and you used to pick up the bus at Bayshore and come downtown, well, a lot of the folks are working from home, and that dynamic probably is not going to change. So the question becomes, all right, what do we need to do? And one of the ideas that's being kicked around is, okay, maybe we should just bite the bullet and say, look, we're going to expect the taxpayers to come up. Let's even forget about charging fares. We want to encourage people to ride mass transit, so we're just going to have the taxpayers pick it up. We're going to have them pick up the $27 million that is generated by passenger fares and other revenue. Wouldn't have to be all of that because some of it's advertising. And then we'll figure out a way to make up the other, you know, $30 million that we're going to lose from the American Relief Act. Is that the way to approach it? 855-616-1620. One of our texters says, Jeff, the numbers you're throwing out are spot on, and they're another reason why we shouldn't be into talks about expanding the hop at this present time, especially with inflation as it is. Well, the hop, of course, is exclusively the city of Milwaukee. But yeah, you look at these numbers, you look at where mass transit is, and the idea that we would be talking about committing tens of millions of dollars to expand the hop is just absolutely crazy. It's also one of the reasons why, and the bus system is looking at another not so high speed bus line to run from 27th Street from Oak Creek all the way up to like Bayshore and Glendale. And that's going to cost like, I think, $100+ million. You just don't have it. And here's where I come from. I think there's got to be a consolidation of routes. You cannot, if you're going to have a vibrant mass transit system, I understand it's kind of a, in some respects, it's kind of internally contradictory. You want it to be able to go places. You want people to be able to ride it. But at the same time, it needs to be cost effective. And if you have too many routes that almost nobody is riding and they are money losers, there's not enough ways that you can have to subsidize that. I mean, it's one thing if you had 12 routes and 10 of the routes were just kicking butt and they were just generating all sorts of revenue and things like that, so you could afford to, okay, underwrite the cost of those other two routes that were losers. But that's not the reality right now. The reality is also, I think there's only so many times that you can go to the taxpayers and say, okay, we want this dough. Mary in Lake Geneva. Mary, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
live in Milwaukee or any large city, and yet I know that if we go to straight tech supported or mass transit, I'm paying for you guys for something that you're not using.
Yes, that's exactly right. that's exactly right. Whether it's your federal tax dollars or your state tax dollars, you're exactly right. You are paying for a system that can't be self-sufficient.
Exactly. And so either they need to realign their thinking, or maybe mass transit isn't the way to go because it's not going to solve any problems.
Yeah. Now, thanks for calling, Mary. Now, you know, at this look, and I want to be fair about this. The freeway, you could make that argument. If you don't own a car, you could say, well, wait, my taxes go to support the freeway, and I don't ride on public roads. I don't drive or things like that. And that's the same argument. And so to an extent, I think, you know, we can't expect, you know, the roads to be self-sufficient. We can't, the tax dollars go to that. I think tax dollars have a role of going to mass transit. But to your point, Mary, I agree. There is a limitation on that. And the truth of the matter is, if you have, you know, buses that are running empty constantly, if you have routes that for whatever reason, there aren't enough people to support, well, then you got to get rid of those routes. That's not necessarily a bad thing. And I'm not saying get rid of all mass transit. I've been one arguing that the buses, for example, you know, rubber tire buses make a lot more sense than, say, the fixed rail trolley. And I don't think you can argue about that. So I don't want to get rid of the buses. But at the same time, you look at these numbers and there's a limitation. You cannot keep expecting the taxpayers to underwrite costs of systems where fewer and fewer and fewer people are riding on them. And that's just kind of the bottom line of all this. You want to have vibrant mass transit, but if people are choosing not to use it, or the need isn't what it was 5 years ago for whatever, you can't expect Mary in Lake Geneva to be underwriting that over and over again. And that's some tough choices that are going to end up having to be made. A number of our texters are making the point that they want to see a return to the freeway flyers, which is a great way to get to Summerfest. Also, a couple of our texters are saying, hey, that this not-so-fast mass transit system is a great way to get to Summerfest and things like that. And by the way, that's free. And I do agree with that. It's a way to, if you want to park out at Watertown Plank Road and hop that and get in and go to Summerfest and go back, it's a really good way to do that.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. If this idea were any dumber, it would gobble. And we look to the city of Milwaukee once again, and there are some elected officials that, well, if you're trying to decide where you should be on an issue, you find out where they are and you go the other way, and you're almost always going to be right. And one of those elected officials is Milwaukee Alderman Robert Wrongway Bauman, who is almost always wrong about everything. And he might have outdone himself on this one. All right. There, downtown, off of St. Paul Avenue, there is what they call the intermodal station, which is kind of a fancy word. It's the bus depot and it's the train station. All right. And it's actually, it was redone about 15, 20 years ago. And it's actually, I think that the train station is actually quite nice. I was there a week ago Thursday. Fran and I went with our dear friends Alan and Patty. We took the train down to Chicago. We saw a matinee, a performance of West Side Story, took the train back. It was a great way to go. You avoided the hassles. I loved it, and I loved being there. Now, the problem, of course, is you have to get from your home to the train station. And then once you get there, you have to park the car. There is a parking lot immediately next door to the intermodal station. And it's a surface parking lot, and you pull in, and the way it works is you pull into a parking space, and then they have one of these meters, and you go up, and you put in a credit card. It was $8 for the day. And they have you can leave your car parked there overnight, and you can leave your car I think there's at least 3 days. I forget what the rate was if you parked for 3 days. And maybe there's longer-term parking. Don't know. But anyways, you know, we pulled in the spot. We pull in the spot, you know, 218 or whatever it is. You go up, you put your credit card in, $8, and you don't even need a receipt or anything. It just records the fact that the car in that spot is parked for X amount of time. And it's actually extremely convenient. It's a 5-minute walk into the bus depot, train station, et cetera. But it is an exposed surface lot. And this is the city of Milwaukee where people will break into and steal everything. So what's happened is there have apparently over the last year or two been a series of break-ins of vehicles at this open-air lot. So, you know, no surprising because, like I say, this is Milwaukee. You leave your car, you know, unattended in your, you leave it unattended in your driveway. Chances are it could be stolen. You park your car in front of, you know, Fiserv Forum or in that area. You come back, the windows are busted, your car has been vandalized. So it's no surprise that you have vandals that, you know, come in the middle of the night and they go through like cars. In the last year, a police investigation on the parking lot reported 13 separate instances in which officers were dispatched to the lot for complaints ranging from break-ins to thefts of cars. All right. If nothing else, I will tell you, I'm kind of surprised that the number is only 13. I'm not minimizing it, but given the fact that theft is so out of control in the city of Milwaukee, and most of this stuff occurs overnight. I'll be honest with you, I did not feel unsafe at all. Of course, it wasn't my car. My buddy Alan drove. Easy for me. It was. We didn't take my car, but Alan drove. I wasn't thinking. We were there from 11. We came back at like 5 or 6. I wasn't afraid that somebody was going to vandalize Alan's car. Didn't think that was going to happen. It was his car, not mine. But anyways, you know, I did not feel unsafe. But at the same time, would I necessarily feel comfortable leaving my car or my friend's car there overnight? Whole different story. But at the same time, I'm not sure there's a lot of parking lots in downtown Milwaukee that I'd feel comfortable leaving my friend's car at overnight as well. So anyhow, you've had 13 break-ins or car thefts on this lot. The lot is owned by, the way it works is this lot is owned by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Right, the Wisconsin DOT owns it, but the DOT leases the whole property to an outfit called Milwaukee Intermodal Partners. So DOT leases it to Intermodal Parkers, and Milwaukee Intermodal Partners has leased the parking lot to Interstate Parking, which is an outfit that runs parking lots all over the area. So the Department of Transportation says, well, it's, you know, we've leased it. It's not our responsibility to handle this. And Milwaukee Intermodal Partners, the people that run the train bus depot, they say we've leased the parking lot to again, Interstate Parking. So it's really their responsibility. So into this weighs the, you know, brainiacs on the Milwaukee Common Council. And Alderman Robert Wrongway Bauman is looking at this, and he says, well, first of all, you know, you've got these different break-ins. Here's what I think. We got to blame the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. And the DOT says, we've leased this. You know, this isn't, we're not running this parking lot. We are not in the business of running parking lots. We've leased the train station. The train station's leased the parking lot. First of all, it's not our responsibility. Nevertheless, you know, we have worked at some upgrades and stuff, but we're not running the parking lot. If you're going to run the parking lot, you know, you got to look at the people that are paying for the right to run the parking lot and are getting the revenue from running the parking lot. Okay, so that's their point. Nevertheless, Bauman wants to blame the Department of Transportation, even though they've leased it. But secondly, the response that the Common Council has is they are considering pulling the permit. In other words, pulling the permit for the parking lot, denying it a license to operate. So you wouldn't be able, their response to crime in this area is to say to the parking operators, crime is so bad that we're not going to let you run the parking lot, which means people who want to take the train or the bus and leave their cars there will have no place to park. Okay, how does this make any sense at all? let me suggest an alternative. And by the way, I mean, it does sound like it would be advisable for, in this case, the parking lot operators to, you know, touch up to add a little bit of security enhancements. I'm not opposed to that. You know, maybe more patrols and things like that. But rather, this would be my comment to the Milwaukee Common Council. And this is kind of their thinking that they express in so many occasions. Rather than saying, we're not going to let people park in the lot, we're going to pull the permit, which essentially, what are you going to do then? I mean, then you're scrambling to try to find a convenient place to park if you want to take the train or you want to take the bus for a day trip to Chicago or, you know, an overnight trip to Chicago or whatever. But instead of focusing on we're going to pull the operator's permit to run the lot, I have a different suggestion. Why don't you deal with the underlying problem, which is crime? Okay, maybe if this is an big issue and you've got people that are vandalizing cars or stealing cars, maybe you want to add a couple police patrols there. Maybe you want to apprehend the bad guys and get them off the street. And heaven forbid, once they get kicked over into the Milwaukee court system, maybe we want to see that the bad guys get prosecuted. It just drives me absolutely crazy. My head wants to explode. And you can watch us on camera if that ever happens. But my head wants to explode. The response is, oh, we have people breaking into this public parking lot that's next to the train station, and that's adversely affecting people. Because, sure, you come back from a day trip to Chicago or whatever, and you find your car has been broken into. Yes, I understand why you'd be hacked off about that. But what is the response? It's to say to the parking lot operator, we're going to pull your permit. Maybe it should be, let's figure out what the underlying problem is. And the underlying problem is you have criminals who operate with impunity in this community. And maybe the answer should be, we got to figure out, I want to talk to the police chief. I want to encourage more police presence. When we catch the people who've stolen cars off the lot or vandalized the cars, I want to see them prosecuted. And by the way, I wouldn't stop at the parking lot and the intermodal lot. If you want to talk about something that really kills a city, it's the fact that you can't park a car without being afraid that it's going to be vandalized, without afraid that it's going to being afraid that it's going to be stolen. Maybe rather than saying, well, I'm going after the Department of Transportation, they need to build a bigger fence, which may or may not be a bad idea. And if they don't build a fence, I'm going to pull the lot's permit to operate, which the Department of Transportation, all that does is hurt the commuters. Maybe we want to concentrate on the underlying problem, which is why are criminals allowed to roam the streets of Milwaukee, vandalizing and stealing cars without fear of consequences? Instead of we're going to pull the permit on the lot. That's the Milwaukee way. At least it's the way the Common Council approaches things. And it's one of the reasons why, at least when it comes to crime, things are out of control around here. Pull the permit on the parking lot so commuters don't have any place to park. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It really is incredible how dumb that this idea is about pulling. We're going to close down the big parking lot where commuters park if they want to take the train or the bus because, well, there's been a bunch of break-ins in that lot. That is like saying, rather than dealing with the underlying problem, which is the criminals that are breaking in the car, here, we're going to close the lot. That is like saying, all right, we're going to stop issuing permits to allow you to park on the street in Milwaukee because your cars get stolen or your cars get vandalized. It's like it's your fault that we cannot control crime. Huh. Give me a break. Hey. Join WTMJ Sandy Max and the American Red Cross for our WTMJ Cares event, the Milwaukee County Zoo Blood Drive. Donate blood during this three-day drive. It starts a week from today, Monday, June 26th. It runs through next Wednesday, the 28th, to help boost the supply of necessary blood during the shortage. Plus, if you register for this event, you'll get free zoo admission and tickets to Summerfest. The Summerfest tickets are available while supplies last. For more information and to sign up, text the word blood, B-L-O-O-D, to 855-616-1620. It's WTMJ Cares with our very own Sandy Max and with the help of our friends from Gruber Law Offices. So check that out. That is our latest event. Okay. Back in the day, I remember going to Marquette men's basketball team. And for the people who might be kind of new to the show, I'm a graduate of Marquette Law School. But all my life I've been a huge Marquette fan. And I'm one of these people that still clings to the days back before political correctness took over and they were actually called the Marquette Warriors. You know, I'm one of those, you know, GOWs, the grumpy old Warriors. Now I understand that they're the Golden Eagles and things like that. But I can remember going to the games and back in the day, one of the arch rivals of the Marquette team was the Cincinnati Bearcats. And the Cincinnati Bearcats were coached by a guy named Bob Huggins. And Huggins, well, he was a very, very controversial figure. When he was coaching and winning at Cincinnati, the graduation rate, Charlie, take a guess. Bob Huggins, he's coaching college basketball at, you know, student athletes and all that. His overall graduation rate, the number of people who actually graduated from the basketball program, what percentage would you guess of the students were? Just take a guess.
60%.
60%. Ho. No. During his tenure at Cincinnati, 28%. 28% of the quote-unquote student athletes graduated. There were seasons, honest to God, there were seasons where nobody graduated. Nobody in the entire program graduated, you know, 0 for 19, whatever. I mean, it's just kind of staggering. And Huggins's response to that was essentially, well, let me see, I've got the exact quotation here. His exact response was he'd been hired to win games and that recruiting at Cincinnati was never easy. Well, okay, that's true. He was hired to win games, and yes, it was probably tough to recruit at Cincinnati, but let us just say that athletics and Bob, you know, educating student athletes and Bob Huggins were never terms that you necessarily hear in the same sentence. But so he was always kind of controversial like that, and he was flamboyant, but he's very, very successful. He went from, after they blew him out at Cincinnati, because he got on the wrong side of one of the new the new administrator at Cincinnati, and then he got nailed for a DUI. But the president didn't like the fact that, you know, Cincinnati would recruit all these kids, and there was really the academics were just a joke. And then he got nailed for drunk driving, and so they used that as an excuse to blow him out. He went to coach at West Virginia, where he's originally from, and he's kind of viewed as a superstar at West Virginia, and he's been there. He's now 69 years old. You might remember Huggins was in the news a few months ago when he sat down and he did an interview with, you know, some people who used to, again, some Cincinnati broadcasters who he knew, and he took off on the Xavier fans, and he made some homophobic references, and then he managed to offend pretty much everybody because it was homophobic references, and then he made, you know, disparaging references to Xavier, which is a Catholic university. So he went after the Catholics, he went after the gay community. It was just, I mean, it was not good. So in response to this, what happened is they docked him $1 million. He makes $4 million a year coaching Cincinnati, and they suspended him for coaching West Virginia. They suspended him for a couple games and docked him $1 million in his salary. Okay, so that was going to be the end of it. Well, he's now out at West Virginia because the other day, well, he announced Saturday that he was resigning. He was arrested Friday night in Pittsburgh, coming back from a basketball camp that he'd been doing, and his car is like over at the side of the road, and the tire is blown out, and it's down to its rims, and he's dead drunk. He blew a .21. Now, .08 is, of course, the level of an intoxication, so he's like 2.5 times the legal limit. They open his trunk, and apparently there's just beer cans and stuff like that. It's not funny. It's lucky that he had to kill somebody. But, you know, he's dead drunk. He's driving on the road. And they were going to – this was kind of the last straw. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. So he was going to be fired, but he's resigned, and, you know, he's apologized for all this. It's one of these things where, just kind of like the Bobby Knight situation in Indiana – You reach a point where you just you got to realize that your life is kind of spinning out of control on certain things, and maybe you need to kind of rein it in. And I think, matter of fact, you could probably go back and check the tape, because when we talked about the Bob Huggins thing a couple months ago, I'm pretty sure I said on the air, but I know I thought to myself that this there's going to be some other shoe that drops in the very near future. I didn't think it was going to only take 2 months for this to do this. Interestingly enough, though, America is a country of second and third and fourth and fifth chances. No question about it. My guess is if Huggins wants to come back into basketball, there will be somebody in the next year or so that will pay him millions of dollars to take over and run their program, even at the age of 70. Why? Because with all that baggage, bottom line is he's a winner. And a lot of times that's what the colleges want. Here's my favorite text of the day. Jeff, one of the great things about the topics you discuss is when I'm watching you on the WTMJ live streaming feed, I get to see your head explode. Great entertainment. Absolutely. That's just another reason to be one of the many people who like log in and watch us do spoken word radio, because you have some of these things. Let's close down the only parking lot next to the train station because crime is so out of control, instead of going after the criminals. Yes. Boom. There goes my head. Yes, and you can watch that live on our live stream. All right. Her head isn't exploding. WTMJ Breaking News time is 2:32 p.m. from the WTMJ Breaking News Center, but not Head Exploding Center. It's Jennifer Gatzo. Jessica Gatzo. Sorry.
No worries. Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, so Jessica, you got to bear with me because here's the story. John McCure's afternoon news partner for years and years was Melissa Barkley, and Melissa, we became very, very close, and she's just a wonderful person. Every once in a while, for some reason, I would blank, and I used to call her Elizabeth Barkley. I don't know where Elizabeth Barkley came from, but it would be, okay, and we worked together, and honest to goodness, we worked together for years, and it would be, okay, here with WTMJ Breaking News, it's Elizabeth Barkley, and then I'd look at her, and she'd look at me, and Melissa it is, so... It's just, you know, we don't have name tags here, but it's just I don't know, kind of like these like senior moments or something like that. So you're in good company. That's all I'm saying.
I see. So
Jessica is in good company. And now that I've made this notation, it's never going to be Jennifer. It's going to be Jessica. I know that. So, Melissa, that's my, like, reach out to you as well, that I understand sometimes it's just you got to keep working on that. When we come back, hey, you know what happens Thursday? It's Summerfest. Want to talk to you a little bit about that. Stick around. This is Jeff Wagner. Yes, one of our texters points out that Elizabeth Berkley was one of the young lady actors on the 90s NBC sitcom Saved by the Bell. Jeff must have had a secret crush on her. I don't know about that. Wasn't Elizabeth Berkley, she was also, forget the Saved by the Bell, wasn't she the one, and she starred in Showgirls, which was one of the truly awful movies. She portrayed an exotic dancer or a showgirl in Las Vegas. And that's a movie that left absolutely nothing to the imagination. But I don't think that's what it was. I don't know. It was just Melissa Barkley, Elizabeth Berkley. I don't know, but we got past it. And we will get past it with Jessica as well. All right. As we were mentioning earlier in the program, this Thursday is the start of Summerfest. Summerfest this year, over three consecutive weekends, Thursday through Saturday, which is, and this year's really, I think, as I was saying earlier, it's going to be a pretty good indication of whether this new schedule works or not. Last year was the first year that they did it and the traditional Summerfest dates, but it was still, last year we were coming out of COVID, so it's kind of a tough indicator. The year before that, they did Thursday through Saturday, but it was in the fall, and that was not much of an indicator. But this will be a good year to see, you know, what does it do to entertain? What does it do to momentum? What does it do to revenue? What does it do to attendance? It's going to be a good indicator. And if you look at the Summerfest lineup, a lot of good performers that are there. I'm going to be going Saturday night. I think it's Saturday night. Sheryl Crow and James Taylor. I know we're going to be going there, and we'll probably go down and see a couple other shows as well. And I always hang around after my broadcasts and kind of wander around and try to catch some of the mid-afternoon shows, which is always a great way to be. But I thought I mean, this is Juneteenth, so I know it's a holiday for some people. And, we, you know, we could be talking about some of the heavy stuff. But I thought we'd have a little bit of fun in this segment of the program. Summerfest is 55. Summerfest is a mature festival. And you can never, I think sometimes we take things for granted. And you assume that, oh, you know, this is, you know, because something's been there, it's always going to be there. And that's just not true. I mean, the reality is there's all sorts of, particularly when you look at music festivals, there's festivals that start and they're really hot for a couple years and then they just kind of disappear. Summerfest, which is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful local treasure, has continued. And, you know, as somebody who has been going to Summerfest, honest to goodness, literally since there was a Summerfest, I mean, I can just, whenever I walk down there and I just see all the things that have gone on the grounds and all the building. I remember when the old main stage was at the north end of the grounds, and you know, you'd get there and it was pretty much like open seating, and it would rain and it would turn into a mud pit. And in general, if you had to go to the bathroom, there were porta potties all over and all that stuff. And I can remember 50 cent beers. I can remember the year that they went to dollar beers, double size, and I learned the hard way that you can't drink as many, you know, 24-ounce dollar beers as you could 12-ounce 50-cent beers. Remember that absolutely the hard way. But I've got a lot of good memories about Summerfest. And given the fact that it's going to open Thursday, given the fact that it's been such an ingrained part of our community, and given the fact that almost everybody has gone to Summerfest at some point in time or another, I want to ask you your favorite memory. Our number, 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Your favorite Summerfest memory. 855-616-1620. Back to discuss in just a moment. Fifty-fifth edition of Summerfest kicks off on Thursday. We're talking Summerfest memories. Linda in West Bend. Linda, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Linda.
My favorite memory is probably 1978. Three Dog Night was at Summerfest. My girlfriend and I went to hear them. We stayed till the end and closed out Summerfest. We were driving home Wisconsin Avenue at a stop-and-go light. Limo pulls up next to our car. The window goes down. It's Three Dog Night. Going, hey, girls. And they're like, you know, you want to party? You want to, you know, have some more fun? And we're like, okay. You know, then I remember, it's 1978. We're all of 18 years old. So we follow. They end up at the Hyatt Regency. They had rented out the Polaris room up on top that rotated around.
Right.
They had all free food, free drinks. We got to meet and talk to the whole band. One of them gave me their, you know, like the patch. Back then they wore patches, like a stage pass thing, and ripped it off his jeans and put it on my pair of blue jeans. And I don't know, it's my favorite memory. It was just so much fun. It was like,
okay.
I don't know if that even happens anymore.
Okay, Linda, now this, what I'm about to say, this is not something that a gentleman asks a lady, so I apologize for that up front. But you know what everybody that's listening to us is asking now? It's like, okay, how did the evening end up? Everybody wants to know that, Linda.
We were good girls.
Okay.
We stayed for a few drinks, we ate some food, we talked, and then we went home.
Okay.
Again, 1978, we were 18. I didn't do stuff like that. So
okay.
We just kind of went and we saw that it was a hotel. We were kind of looking at each other and we go, well, let's just go inside. There's a lot of people there.
Okay.
But when it went up to the Polaris room, we were like, okay. So, yeah.
Okay. That is
we were good girls.
That is a great story. And again, Linda, I apologize for an ungentlemanly question, but everybody wanted to know. Thanks for the call. Inquiring minds wanted to know, you know, how did that evening end? You're partying with Three Dog Night up in the Polaris, the revolving Hyatt restaurant, and apparently they were good girls. Let's see. Lisa in Mequon. Lisa, you're on WTMJ.
Well, first of all, who can trump Linda's story? That was
okay, but give it a try. Give me yours.
Thanks for opening with Seals and Cross music, because that's my memory. I think it was the first year. It was a complete mud fest, and my mother dropped my friend and I off, and we decided to go through Summerfest not wearing any shoes that entire evening. So I think it was the time. It just was the right look back then in the 70s.
Absolutely. So you're not going to tell me you ended up partying with Seals and Croft and ending up in some hotel bar or anything with them?
I did end up partying with Peter Frampton, however, in a bar after a concert.
Really?
But yes, I did. And but I don't think it was Summerfest. No. I think it was a standalone concert.
Okay.
Good old days.
The good old days. Thanks for the call, Lisa. That was probably Lisa's phone ringing. Some people, are you guys really on the radio talking about how you ended up at a bar with Peter Frampton? Peter Frampton, of course, who hasn't necessarily aged that well, but Peter Frampton, who was, Frampton Comes Alive. That was the big record of 1970, whatever. And I just remember, everybody had that. So it's kind of interesting. We've got these listeners out partying with Seals and party with Peter Frampton. Interesting. Jeff, many memories. My favorite Summerfest memory has to be meeting my now wife in 1997 at the America, that is the band America's concert. Jeff, back around 2008, my favorite memory was seeing Milwaukee's own The Guffs on a side stage. They sounded so very great. You know, that is one of the cool things about Summerfest is that a lot of times you just kind of wander around and you might stumble across this band that nobody's ever heard of, and it's you and it's 50 people sitting on the bleachers there, watching them play. And then, a year later or 6 months later or 3 months later or whatever, they end up, hitting it big. Jeff, I remember the 1970 Summerfest, the first one on the current grounds, then a recently decommissioned Cold War missile launch site emerged where my mom and I saw Mahalia Jackson perform on a portable trailer stage. This was before there were any permanent ones. It's impossible. It's just, if you weren't around at the beginning, it's impossible to describe how the grounds have changed over the years with all the paving stuff and all. One of our texters mentions what would be one of my top five Summerfest memories, the Humble Pie Riot, hiding under a picnic table to avoid thrown beer bottles. It was the last night of Summerfest, which was a Sunday. Humble Pie, which was an English rock band, this was 1973, and it's just... The crowd, I was at that show, and I remember turning around. There's a sea of people and beer tent. There's people sitting on beer tents, and they're overturning porta-potties. They're overturning porta-potties. People, people might, want to use those things. But, it was a riot. People were, smashing beer barrels and starting bonfires. There were several hundred people that were arrested. So that was the night of the Humble Pie Riots. And I remember the response after that was to say, okay, we're not going to book rock bands again. And so for a couple years after that, you had the Beach Boys and you had Gladys Knight and groups like that. My top Summerfest memory, and I've told this story before, so I apologize if you heard it, so many people claim that they were at the Ice Bowl in Green Bay. I was not at the Ice Bowl in Green Bay. I was at Summerfest the night that George Carlin got arrested in 1972 for the seven words you can't say on TV or in Milwaukee. He was not the headliner. The headliner was Arlo Guthrie and Pete Seeger, Arlo Guthrie being Woody Guthrie's kid. And he was big at the time because of the movie, the song Alice's Restaurant and things like that. And then... I remember the opening acts, including one of the opening acts was the band that does One Toke Over the Line. I remember that they were, you had that and you had the Siegel Schwal Blues Band. I remember that night like it was yesterday, and nobody knew that Carlin had been arrested until afterwards. Dawn in Delavan. Dawn, you're on WTMJ.
Hi. You made me think of a memory. I don't know the year, but I took my son and my nephews, teenagers, to go see Sugar Ray.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I can do this. No big deal. Aunt Dawn's got it all handled. And I was talking to my son and his friend, and I'm like, where's Ryan? And they turned and they're like, there he goes. He's crowd surfing over the crowd to the front of the stage. I thought, epic aunt fail.
Aunt fail. How am I going to explain to my sister or my brother that their kid just ended up at the front?
Exactly. He had a quick, I was hysterical, but we found him an hour later. It was okay.
It turned out okay. All right. That's it. He's off there. He's off crowd surfing. Brewer and Shipley was the band that did One Toke Over the Line. Okay, bottom line, that's the fun thing about going to these venues. And, you know, you have these memories, and it's worth doing it. It's worth experiencing that because you never know. You might be listening to the radio 30 or 40 years from now, and some guy's going to say, what's your favorite memory? And you can say, I remember when I was 22 years old in 2023, and I was at Summerfest, and I don't know, I saw X, Y, or Z. That's the fun thing.